Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by an under-the-weather Matt Kinnear. Matt, you have not coughed yet. We're 5 seconds into the podcast. Congratulations.
This is going to be the most professional podcast ever. I'll be drinking water the whole time. I'll be coughing, and I sound like a person who's been smoking for 50 years. So pump for this one.
And that is the cause of the delay. We apologize for not coming at you on the normal Wednesday, but we hope that you enjoy this on your Thursday commute home. We will be coming back tomorrow with a recruiting podcast, special guest, Corgan Sports Enterprises head janitor. That's what he calls himself, Lee Corgan. And then we'll be talking about this week and actually kind of the last 2 weeks, because last week on the recruiting podcast with Rory Doucette, we did not really go over the news of the day. Certainly a big switched commitment over the weekend that we will dive into. So a lot to come on that podcast tomorrow. But Matt, I think this is going to be a well-received one.
I think so.
We're talking about the Top 25 Face-Off Yearbook, Top 25, unveiled on InsideLacrosse.com Wednesday afternoon. Make sure to check out InsideLacrosse.com to purchase a Face-Off Yearbook. You can get it on your tablet. You can get the print copy in your hand, carried around all season, take notes in it. One of our newest members of our team, Megan Clothier, said that her dad, who is an ardent lacrosse fan, she took the book home the day that it got delivered to the office, and he just sequestered himself into his most comfortable chair for 90 minutes and devoured it. That's exactly the type of thing we love to hear, and we are really gratified to bring you what I think is the 25th Face-Off Yearbook. Might be 26. Do we know definitively?
Maybe 24, maybe 26. It's kind of like our 20th anniversary.
Exactly. We don't know. We're not math guys. That's what it comes down to. So that being said, we did attempt to put Division I men's lacrosse teams in order, which certainly is a mathematical proposition.
Speaking of, you just talked about putting notes in the yearbook. Did you get Quint's, did Quint tear it up yet and put his notes in it?
Not yet, actually. So I was texting with him this morning, and he was asking who are the folks that people are most upset about being underrated or overrated or ranked, I suppose. And we'll get to it, but I was like, I haven't seen a ton. I think that folks thought that Denver was a little low at 5, Yale was a little high at 3, so maybe the consensus is that switching those two would have been a little bit more appropriate. And then aside from that, the only other team in the top 20 that I saw, multiple comments that saying that they were probably ranked a little too low was Army at 17. But let's start at the top. Duke is number one. It's an interesting choice relative to some of the other candidates to be number one. It is to some degree reminiscent of 2010 when we picked them number one in Face-Off Yearbook. They went on to win the program's first national championship. And, I think that, what we saw that year, Ned Crotty went on to win the Twardon Award. And one of the things that gives me a little bit of confidence in the Blue Devils is the idea of Justin Gooderding doing the same, turning into a similar type of player. Having spoken to John Donowski last weekend, he said something that was really surprising. In the fall, they experimented with running Gooderding out of the box as a midfielder to see if they could create some matchup havoc. I've talked about Gooderding in terms that are similar to Connor Fields in the sense that I'm really impressed by both of those guys' ability to start their careers as goal scorers, particularly lefty goal scorers, and then transition into behind the cage, more two-handed, more dual threat, score and assist type of attackman. And I think having spent some time in Durham this fall, you can kind of see the leadership qualities that Gooderding represents. And so when you consider some of the other attributes that this team brings to the table, certainly I have to replace their face-off specialist, and that's always a tough task. But a lot of the teams that are in contention, at the top of the rankings do, with notable exceptions at Albany and Denver, they're fortunate relative to a lot of their peers in the sense that they bring back their goalie. They've got a ton of midfield depth, some of which it is proven. Brad Ross taking the next, or I'm sorry, slipped on that one. Brad Smith taking the next step, being somewhere between a foregone conclusion and something that people say this needs to happen in order for Duke to meet its potential. But one of the things that we saw last year, particularly with the young guys, Terry Lindsay and Kevin Quigley and Riley Walsh and more, Sean Pendergast was a guy who I think exceeded a lot of expectations last season. They just have so much depth. They have so many options. And so, probably their biggest hole on offense is replacing Jack Bruckner. They do have some replacements that need to take place at the short stick D midfield position, but I take a lot of solace not just in the fact that Danny Fowler is back in goal, and I do expect him to be pushed a little bit, but their 1-2 punch at the top of their defensive, their close defense is just, No other team can offer what Cade Van Rapphorst and JT Giles Harris bring in terms of their athleticism and their tenacity. And it's akin to having not just one, but two lockdown corners. If you have two defensemen that you feel comfortable matching up against your opponent's best players and taking them out of the game, the cascading effect that has for the other four guys on your defense and also for your faceoff unit. You know, you don't have to worry about winning 57% to 60% of the draws if you feel comfortable that you're going to get stops at a rate higher than your opponent. So for me, that rounded out the argument for why Duke was a qualified number one choice.
I think I'm always going to go with depth above depth and just and kind of the proven factor that Duke has, you know, proven as a program, not just what these guys have done. Because, you know, these guys have had some exits that have been pretty.
That's a great point. They're proven, but they still have something to prove.
Right.
You know, they're proven in the sense that you don't feel like the moment's going to overwhelm them if they get to the Final Four or Memorial Day Monday. But at the same time, you do feel like there's internal motivation based on the fact that they haven't, you know, this senior class has not reached the Final Four.
You look at the guys behind them. I just don't see a team that has the depth at every position that they do. Obviously, minus the faceoff X, you know, which is, frankly, might be the biggest concern. My question is Duke going to have the biggest swing of rankings we've ever seen in terms of their normal February kind of drift back to the back half of the top 20, starting from number one, drifting back, you know, to the number 20 or maybe beyond, then drifting back to number one and going to the national championship? Is that going to happen this year?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a trope that is well-worn, and I think we all understand. And I think the last 3 years have represented an interesting test to that analysis, right? So you think about it from the approach that the coaching staff takes, right? The, you know, generally don't play fall ball. I'm sorry, don't play a fall scrimmage. You know, have a lot of those two games in 3 days at the beginning of the season. There's this aura or myth around what they do during spring break with their shooting academy and everything that goes into that. And you see them round into form late in the season. And a lot of times, over the last 3 years, it's proven to be at least moderately overstated, you know, particularly given the fact that they've not been competitive in the games in which they've exited the NCAA tournament. But prior to that, you know, remember their win over Notre Dame last year? That was really surprising. Or if not surprising, it was at the very least impressive. And so those are the types of moments that happen in April that make you feel like it'd be foolish if we didn't buy Duke stock right now heading into May.
Definitely. And I'm curious from you, having seen them, you know, with this project, the season that we're doing, the football influence is kind of the big fall theme of this team. How have you seen that with this defense particularly?
They're physical. I think that's probably the core aspect. It's funny because, you know, I mentioned Van Rapphorst and Giles Harris, and certainly the football influence does not end there. Nekhai Montgomery was, you know, an excellent running back at Episcopal School of Dallas, and Dino said this past weekend he expects him to get on the field. He expects him to make a contribution as a freshman. When you look specifically at those two guys, though, Giles Harris and Van Rapphorst, one was a quarterback, one was a defensive back. You know, I think Van Rapphorst was also an outside linebacker, and so, you know, because of the nature of defense, I think the idea of a quarterback surveying the opposing defense and making calls to change the approach is akin to what a leader on defense has to do. But from a physical standpoint and an athlete's perspective, you know, I look at being a defensive back or an outside linebacker and the combination of matching feet, turning your hips, and being physical with your push at your point of contact, and specifically in lacrosse where there's no such thing as pass interference, moving your assignment in a direction that he doesn't want to go as being, you know, that's what it's all about. You know, it's probably all is too strong of a term, but that's what a lot of it is about. The other portion is about support, right? And so, you know, that's where it's a fully developed athletic profile. It's not just about being a football player. You can't be a football player and transition immediately into lacrosse. But if you're a football and basketball player, because of the nature of support and playing defense in basketball, you've got a lot of the tools necessary to be a good defender in lacrosse.
Speaking of guys who played other sports, our number two team in the country, Albany.
And I would assume that's a segue into T.D. Erland's wrestling background and how he is the straw that stirs the drink in so much of what the Great Danes do.
No.
Upset City.
It's a reference into Connor Field's hockey background and how he could have played high-level hockey in college if he wanted to, but he wanted to play lacrosse. And just, you know, I think that's part of the reason that you see him so good in tight spaces, so good in contact. He's not the biggest guy in the world by any means. you can't really knock him over. And when you do, when you make contact with him is when he makes something happen, which is so remarkable about his game. But TD is just, side note, he's super impressive. That was a big miss for us with the Under Armour All-America game, but that's a different story.
The thing about hockey players that you mentioned, you can't knock him over. So I mentioned Ned Crotty earlier, and there was a guy I'm going to call back that only the deepest Darien, Connecticut, and Loyola fans are going to appreciate, Cooper McDonnell. You know, those are two guys that when I first saw them run, it was like they were skating on land. And I think to your point about how you don't get knocked over, it's typically because your upper body posture and the way it correlates to your center of gravity means that you kind of sit lower and your legs move in kind of like this much more fluid but kind of round way that reminds me of the Tasmanian devil when he starts up. You know how like Tasmanian devil's feet would spin and then he would just go off? That's kind of what a hockey player looks like to me when he runs. And the reason it's so beneficial for an attackman is because, particularly if you're dodging from X, when you get topside and you start to absorb not just the contact from the guy who's guarding you, but somebody that's hedging adjacent and trying to get a check-in on your stick, the way in which you can use your shoulders to protect your stick and then turn back to the inside and get a good look is why so many of these guys are so effective. And you can build your game off of being able to be effective in getting to the goal from X. It can be one of the most dangerous skills that an opposing defense needs to protect against, because once you get guys above GLE looking down below GLE to try to decide whether they have to slide, well, that's when you can take two steps, see somebody coming toward you, and throw through the defense for a much easier shot. And then all of a sudden, you're a dual threat attackman. And that's exactly what we saw Connor Fields develop into, over the course of his sophomore year, but certainly last year as a junior, as a bona fide Twarton candidate, and as the guy who I think in 7 out of 10 years would enter this season as the Twarton favorite. I would argue that right now he is not, and that's kind of it's kind of a shock.
Yeah, and I mean, look who he's throwing the ball to. Justin Ray, I think, is going to have a monster year.
Is he like your, adjusted for how famous they are, favorite player heading into the 2018 season?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I think he's, obviously, like, watching them at Syracuse against the Israel national team was just incredible. The way that Toka just takes so much attention on the crease. He has to, partially just because he's so freaking big. This guy is a monster. And then Justin Ray is just available right there, time and room shot. And Connor Fields is going to get him every time. You're going to see Justin Ray have a monster season. And it's funny, all the stuff you said about hockey. I was a hockey player. I started playing lacrosse.
Was it total BS or does it resonate with you?
It does, but I mean, I'm going to tell why Connor Fields is good and I wasn't.
Okay.
I was a crease guy, partially because I'm not the fastest guy. I was there because I could just take a hit because I played hockey. I could get ground balls and stuff like that. But my problem was always I just picked up the ball and I just chucked it at the net no matter where I was, because that was that hockey mentality of just
get it on cage.
It's going to be a rebound score. That doesn't work in lacrosse at all. So Connor has taken all the best parts of his hockey background and used them, not the parts that I took that were so.
Number three, the Yale Bulldogs. Well, I mean, before we move on, we've talked about TD. Is there anything else with Albany that you want to address?
Their defense. Is defense good enough? I think it's a big question. And also, we talked about Duke having the history. Albany doesn't. Last year's kind of exit against Maryland was
ignominious.
It was a little shocking how one-sided it was, I think, especially when people saw the first game that they had. You kind of have to wonder, is that this team's ceiling? Do they not have what it takes to get a step further?
Do you think that... How comparable do you think Albany's quarterfinal hurdle is to what Carolina was dealing with after the 2015 season?
I don't think it's very comparable.
I kind of don't either, but it's the one that comes to mind as being the other quarterfinal
curse. The
other
curse. Streak thing that's going on right now.
No. Not that's going on. I mean, obviously they killed it, but like the one that, from whatever it was, 93 to 2015, it was like, how come Carolina can't get back to the Final Four?
There's something interesting about Albany where they're, maybe it's just playing in the America East, where they're always going to have a little bit of this underdog quality to them, even though they're coming into the season ranked number 2 in the country. So I just think that the tone around them is different. It's not, we're going to be disappointed if you don't make it to the Final Four. It's we're excited for the opportunity that you might play in the Final Four.
That's a conversation,
but it's important, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I also feel like in addition to the fact that in addition to the function of where they play and where they're coming from, which has its own advantages in the sense that they're always going to be there, presumably, right? You know, at least relative to the competition. I mean, you know, North Carolina can have a great season at large and have a bad season in the ACC, and you don't have the expectations heading into the NCAA tournament that you're even going to get back to the Final Four, that you're a top four team. You know, and for Albany, they're probably going to put together a pretty gaudy record in their up years. So that does offset that a little bit. Another factor, another reason that it's different is they haven't been there before. It's not about getting back. It's about getting there for the first time. Exactly. And so, as I mentioned, a program for which that is not true, but has not been to the Final Four in quite some time, number three, the Yale Bulldogs. I think that this conversation has structured itself as, why are they ranked that high, and why are they not ranked higher? The argument for why Yale is ranked really high is because, you know, they graduated Eric Scott, and not a lot else. You know, it's to the point that, you know, what they bring back depth-wise is so significant that some of the guys, like, I kind of almost forgot about. The most substantial example of that is Chris Keating, a senior defenseman who missed last season. But when you look at Yale's defense and, you know, there's some guys that you feel good about. Aiden Hines was one of the best freshmen in the country last season. Robert Mooney is a big, effective defenseman who has been really good over the course of his career. And then Jerry O'Connor is a senior who looks like he's ready to take the next step as far as his contributions as the long stick midfielder. You forget about Keating, who's probably going to be their best defenseman last season. So, you know, my point is that at each end of the field, they have not just high-end talent, but also enough depth that they can sustain an injury. But certainly, you know, at the offensive end of the field, in a lot of people's eyes, it starts and ends with Ben Reeves. And I think that that's fair, given his production, given his consistency. I mean, you know, you think about a guy who was a Twarton finalist in 2015, and Twarton finalist in 16. At points in 2017, when he was struggling with injuries, it felt like he wasn't going to get back to that level. And then, lo and behold, 80 points. Here we go. My thing is, his success undersells the contribution that Jackson Morrill has and has made. And it's to the point where I think even if Ben Reeves were to miss a few games due to injury, I don't think their offense is going to take a significant step back. Morrill's arrival has allowed Reeves to operate much more as a wing or behind left player and consumed a lot more of the defensive attention. And when you complement that with Matt Gaudette, who can really suck defenses into the crease because of his catch and finish ability, they've got a really nice combination of talent at that end of the field. But a couple of their midfielders are attackmen by nature as well. So even if they were to lose one or two of those guys to injury, you know, I think they'd be able to find some good contributions from those converted midfielders. To me, their biggest question is in goal. You know, it was a team whose season ended disappointingly in terms of their goalie performance at Syracuse in the first round of the NCAA tournament, which was an 11-10 loss. And the other big question is, how are their top midfielders going to shake out? You think about Jason Alessi spending the fall with the football team. Certainly that's to his, you know, kind of long-term benefit in terms of his contributions to the lacrosse team. It's going to make him a better lacrosse player, presumably. But in the short term, it makes it more difficult to figure out who's playing with whom. You know, I think that there are a number of freshmen who are arriving on campus ready to step in and do something. And I think Lucas Kotler is primed for a breakout. So there's a lot of answers to the question, and I wonder which answer is going to rise to the top. You know, Faceoff X, Connor Mackey is one of the best. Short stick D Mitty, Tyler Warner is one of the best. John Danijelis is the second short stick, and he's probably one of the most underrated players in college lacrosse. And a couple of guys told me when I visited in the fall that he was the most important player on the team. So, you know, just that's the argument for why Yale deserves to be number three. Matt, if you were going to try to take the contrary position, what would your stance be?
Terry, to your point about Ben Reeves, you know, I remember one of the lacrosse analysts talking about looking at film at him. He's like the perfect Yale player. You know, looking at film at him and like, there's nothing overly impressive about this guy, but he's one of the best players in lacrosse. Top three. That's kind of Yale, right?
Apparently he is really fast, which I don't know if I like immediately saw when I watched his game, but like you talk to his teammates, they're like, oh yeah, he's fast. Yeah. So, but that's your point, right? Like, you know, and he apparently has also kind of mastered that Matt Gibson move of like, you get your defender's stick in between your arm and body and you draw him into you. And then you use, I mean, he's big, he's like 6'2" of bona fide 200 pounds. So you use that physicality to like, then create separation and control your defender.
And he's smarter than everyone that's defending him. That's the first thing. But
also anybody who's covering him. Yeah. And by that, I mean us.
Yes. To your point about what's the argument against Yale, I'd say the 3 to 4 teams behind him. You know, I don't think the argument is that Yale isn't deserving as much as those teams. I think you have a very strong argument that are more deserving than Yale.
And certainly that's a function of track record as well. So let's just quickly move on to talk about number 4, Maryland, the defending champions, number 5, Denver, the 2015 champions, and number 6, Notre Dame, who has been a mainstay in the Final Four for the last decade.
Maryland, people are going to talk about the losses. You know, you lose Tourton winner, you lose Colin Heacock, that goes, you know,
hand in hand
with him. But you have Bernhardt, who's going to be one of the best players in the country. Their game against the U.S. national team was really impressive. Obviously, I think there's a tendency to maybe look too much into that particular game, just given the nature of the way that the tryouts work for those guys.
I've fallen into the looked really good against Team USA trap before, so I would say it's a helpful point of evidence, but it is not the end-all be-all.
And I will say, anecdotally, Scott Mark came in here during the convention. Albany ranked number 2 in the country, highest ranking they've ever had. He looks at the book, the first thing he says is, how the hell is Maryland not number 1?
Well, that's the coach's proclivity to give the defending champion number 1 out of respect as opposed to out of argument.
Right.
And we'll talk about the system and process by which we come to these rankings in a little bit. But, I mean, you just said it. Like, look at their identity of who they were. You know, I look at... There are a lot of similarities program-wise between Towson and Maryland. Certainly, when you compare their success, they're equivalent with like a 15% kicker toward Maryland in the sense that, you know, Towson has proven itself to be a consistent conference champion. They, you know, made it to the quarterfinals in 2016, Final Four in 2017. The point that I'm making is they're both struggling or entering the season with the same challenge, that is graduating your entire attack unit. The reason I bring it up is because talking about Towson over Final Four weekend with an alum, I asked, how surprised are you that they've been this successful after all the graduation losses they sustained at the end of 2016 to the defensive end? And how likely do you think it'll be that they can parlay the momentum going forward given what they will graduate at the end of this season? And he said, when you're a system-oriented program, it's easier to plug in replacements at the defensive end of the field because playing defense is more system-oriented. It's more difficult to do it at the offensive end of the field because while you can create systems by which your offensive players consistently get good looks, ultimately it takes a certain kind of uncoachable savvy and charisma to score goals. And if you're dealing with players who enter college lacrosse with a certain talent threshold and you need to push them up and up and up, that requires time and experience. And so, you know, the system might be the same, but the production is going to diminish because the players that you're putting on the field don't have the same level of time and experience accomplishing the goal. And again, it's all relative. Maryland's number 4. We're predicting they're going to make it back to the Final Four based on the rankings and Faceoff Yearbook. We're not talking about a significant step back, but relative to the likelihood that they compete for a national championship, in contrast to the other 3 programs that are ranked ahead of them, you know, it feels like this is a year where they're going to have to spend. It's an investment year as opposed to a payoff year.
And your point about the defense, I remember talking to an assistant coach this fall, you know, doing the fall All Access series, and he said everyone used to coach the Johns Hopkins defense. It was the Johns Hopkins defense was when you hired a coordinator, that's what you wanted to hear, that's what you wanted them to kind of preach. Now it's the Maryland defense. This whole group of assistants from this generation are going out teaching the Maryland defense. So that's a pretty ringing endorsement of what they do back there.
And, you know, moving on to number 5, the Denver Pioneers are as system-oriented offensively as any program in college lacrosse. And it's interesting, you know, we're going to talk about the IMLCA convention at the end of this podcast, and certainly the hottest topic there was the shot clock. It's interesting to think about Denver in the realm of the shot clock. Certainly their coaches and coaching staff have played an active role in helping to move the conversation forward, and I'm certain that there's aspects of their style that they think translate really nicely to the shot clock, some of which I'm sure they've divulged, some of which I'm sure they're keeping closer to the vest. You know, the thing for me about Denver is their offensive efficiency is such a consistent thing. And the reason that Connor Fields is not the Twarton favorite is because Trevor Baptiste is. And Trevor Baptiste is the Twarton favorite, in my opinion, because he is positioned to leave college lacrosse as the best faceoff specialist of all time in an era when faceoff specialists were so much more heavily emphasized than at any other point in the history of the game, combined with the outcome of winning the faceoff was more important to your team's success than at any other point in the history of the game. So basically, when the stakes were highest and the competition was stiffest, this guy managed to put together a resume that, if he continues on his trajectory, will be unrivaled between the volume and the efficiency with which he wins. I mean, if his rate of success increases the way it did from his sophomore to junior year, he's going to win at least 77%, maybe 80% this year. He probably will not set the all-time ground ball record, which is pretty amazing. Probably a function more so of the fact that his team blows out their opponents and they're not playing in close games, so you're not getting as many 15-15 games, and you see Trevor take a lot more 20 face-off games than 30 face-off games. But, I mean, Denver's offense and Denver's defense is a function of how efficient they are at the faceoff X and how good they are at controlling the pace of the game, how much offense they play, how little defense they play. That's the argument for why they're number five. The argument for why they're not numbers 1, 2, 3, or 4 is because I do think that they have a fair amount of question marks, primarily because there were so much of last year's senior class was tied to its leadership core. Guys, and you know, when you're not a part of the team, when you're not in the locker room every day, the idea of addition by subtraction is not something that you can analyze from the outside. And this is certainly not meant to be a condemnation on, you know, any of the guys that were integral to winning a national championship 2 years prior. It's hard for me to believe that the soul of the team is going to be improved after graduating Connor Cannizzaro, Tyler Pace, and Christian Bergdorf. But it is possible. I'm not excusing the fact that it is possible that, you know, there's room for other guys to grow and flourish, and if it correlates to their contributions on the field, maybe that's a good thing, you know?
King Tuna, Trevor Baptiste, what's great about him is, you mentioned about his, you know, kind of uptick in production year over year with at the faceoff X, but how he's gotten so much better with the ball this year playing box lacrosse. He might be a legitimate offensive threat for this team. You know, last year, you look at the Villanova game where he kind of torched them. 2 years ago, they decided, you know, they went after him and, you know, he just gave away the ball and, you know, Denver played its normal efficient offense. Last year, they were like, all right, we'll just let Trevor try to shoot because he's going to throw it over the net. And what did he do? I think he had a hat trick in that game.
He did.
So the way that he's progressed, kind of his stick work and everything else, this guy's a monster. You know, he's going, I think, I still put Connor as the Twarton Award winner.
Okay.
I think offense wins awards. Trevor, though, is, I think you got to say he's the most important player to his team.
Who do you think is Denver's fifth leading returning scorer?
Oh, God.
I'll give you the top four. Ethan Walker is the leading returning scorer.
It.
Yeah. Austin French is second. Colton Jackson is third. Connor Donahue is fourth. Who do you think's fifth?
Who's the other attackman that?
It's Trevor Baptiste. 12 goals and 2 assists. He was he's the fifth leading returning scorer.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and he'll probably put up 25 points.
I should have known that's what you're going for after the setup I just gave you that was perfect for that anecdote.
Yeah, but you made me look good, so I'm okay with it. Let's round out the top six with the Notre Dame Fighting Irish. Certainly a dramatic offseason with Ryder Garnsey's apparent transfer out and then return. He comes back flanked by Mikey Wynn and Brendan Gleason. I would call it an underrated attack unit with a lot of potential. I think the solidness in that third spot, presuming that nobody moves to the midfield, is really nice. And I think, you know, I was very big heading into last year on the importance of Brian Willis to contribute, particularly because of his size and the way in which his style would not it would complement Garnsey and Wynn, in the sense that, like, you know, you've got the slippery off ball guy in Wynn, you've got the Dodger in Garnsey, and then you've got the power guy in Willits. I'm sure that there's a role for him on this team. I think it's a little less defined. I think the power guy coming in is going to be Connor Morin. I think that they expect the freshman to contribute right away. You know, we rank this incoming class number one. I think at the other end of the field, Arden Cohen is going to start, and he's going to defend opponent's best player. I mean, Notre Dame doesn't care about matchups. We know. But he's probably going to defend opponent's best players more frequently than not. And then Kyle Hyland, you know, the face-off axe is a question mark for Notre Dame. They bring back John Travisano, but they graduate P.J. Finley. I think Kyle Hyland, a sophomore who struggled with injuries last season, he just brings something different stylistically. He's tall, he's strong. He's not your typical face-off guy. I think, you know, if he can make a contribution, that'll be really big. And then obviously, you know, they've got to answer the question in goal. I don't know. I don't really have a prediction for who I think is going to start in net for Notre Dame, but you know, that's kind of the story of their season, I think. And one thing that I didn't mention is their rope unit, led by long stick midi John Sexton, short stick Drew Shantz, and then a host of guys, like four or five guys, that can not only fill that second spot but rotate in as the fourth and fifth, or third and fourth guy, excuse me. You know, that's probably the strength of this team, and I think, you know, shutting down opposing midfield units is going to be a common refrain for Notre Dame.
Are we going to look back at this freshman class and just be, not only was it the best class that we saw coming into this year, but the best freshman class, the best class ever?
Well, right now, the best class name would have been the Virginia 2007 class, the class that played the 2008 season, because they were seniors in 11. Mm-hmm. So that would have been Shamel and Rommel, Bray Malfrus, and Adam Gittleman on the cover of that recruiting issue.
We're talking about the number 6 team in the country, and potentially three guys who are going to be extreme impact players on this team that are freshmen.
Yeah. I mean, probably more. You know, we didn't talk about Michael Drake, and I think that there's an expectation that he could start at midfield as well. You know, Carson Cochran, I think, entered the campaign a little bit raw as a big defenseman, a big log pole coming out of Brother Rice in Michigan. But I think that there's some expectation that he could make some contributions. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Just something to replay this 4 years from now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Either I'm vastly wrong or maybe a little bit right.
Matt, we started this podcast talking about your being under the weather. Can you imagine if there was a whole food protein bar with simple, real ingredients that could help you stay healthier?
I can't imagine.
Well, you should be able to imagine because you've eaten one before. And that's because RX Bar has sent us samples to try out, and they were delicious. You know, my big reaction, my first takeaway is when, you know, protein bars I've eaten in the past tend to have a flavor that I would describe as like chalky or science. It tastes like science. RX Bar tastes like a granola bar, right? Like, it's packaged like a protein bar, and it's certainly designed to deliver the same level of contribution to your health and wellness that a traditional protein bar does. But it doesn't taste like a traditional protein bar. RX bars are made with 100% whole ingredients. They want to be transparent and upfront with their customers, which is why they label core ingredients such as egg whites, dates, and nuts on the front of the package, and the ingredients that make up the texture and chase are on the back. So that's like 100% real cacao, coconut, etc. I probably should eat one right now and just take a quick break to record or from recording. But I'm not going to, because I'm committed to you, the listener, and I'm going to put off my RX bar until after we finish recording. Like we said, the core ingredients do all the talking. It's simply like eating 3 egg whites, 2 dates, and 6 almonds. There's no BS. And it turns out, not shockingly, that real food ingredients actually taste good. As I said, it's got much more of a granola bar type flavor than it does a traditional protein bar. Whether you like sweet or savory, chocolate or fruit, there's an RX bar for you. There are 11 different flavor varieties, no gluten, no soy, no dairy, no added sugar, no artificial colors, no artificial flavors, no preservatives, no fillers. The egg whites are for the protein, the dates are to bind, and the nuts are for texture. You can eat them whenever you want. They're great for all occasions. After the gym, for lunch, breakfast, all that good stuff. For 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/lacrosse and enter the promo code lacrosse at checkout. Once again, that is for 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/lacrosse and enter promo code lacrosse at checkout. As always, we really appreciate you guys supporting our partners, and this is one that I have personally tested and would recommend. Now, Matt, we've talked about the top six. For the rest of the top 25 and in-depth previews, you're going to have to check out InsideLacrosse.com. Like I said, purchase the Face-Off yearbook so you have this at your disposal all year long to quickly round out the top 10 so as to not leave you hanging. Rutgers at number 7, Ohio State at number 8, Syracuse at number 9, North Carolina at number 10.
Rutgers, my national championship pick in this yearbook, so representing the Big Ten there.
All right, let's talk about how we got to these rankings. So, you know, it's an interesting process. The way I've characterized Face-Off yearbook rankings, and this is the 10th yearbook I think I've been a part of. I was a part of the 2008 yearbook, and 2010 was a little bit of like a crowning moment for me because I remember ardently lobbying for selecting Duke number one in 2010, and then they went on to win the national championship. Syracuse was the other consideration that year, and we had him number two. And then I remember following that up with in 2011 having a similar conversation, feeling very strongly about Syracuse. You know, it didn't necessarily come to fruition the way that we had hoped, but a defensible pick nonetheless. There have been some notable exceptions going the other way. Certainly, you know, where we ranked Loyola their national championship year is the stuff of legend. And then most recently, you know, I think we had Ohio State number 22 in the 2016 Face-Off yearbook. They obviously went on to finish number two in the country. The dirty secret of these rankings is that the rankings matter less than the functional outcome of the rankings. The Face-Off yearbook rankings order the Division I teams 1 to 71, and they're built in August and September, and they're largely meant to organize the actual book. The priority in Face-Off yearbook are the team write-ups. It's not the rankings. We assign those stories to our crew of writers. Shout out to Christian Sweezy, who handles the top 25. And then the write-ups come back, and we're limited in the changes that we can make at that point because depending on the page that is associated with a specific ranking, the word count is dictated by that. And it takes a lot of work to change teams around if you cross a certain threshold. So, you know, if you're assigned in the top 25, we get your write-up back, look at it in the ecosystem of the other teams that you're ranked around, and you're like, eh. This team had more losses than we realized when we were ranking squads. You know, that could influence the final verdict, and that happened in two notable instances throughout the process. We had Albany ranked number one. At the end of the process, we thought that Duke was a smarter choice at the top of the list. Similarly, we had Air Force in the top 25. You know, given all that's gone on in Colorado Springs this fall, it feels like that's going to have a material impact on their team heading into the 2018 season. And as a result, they're not in the top 25 anymore. When we start, you know, the teams are ordered by their either, you know, previously it had been year-end RPI from the previous season. This year, I started with the rating, the lacrosse analytics, Patrick McEwen, their rating. You know, it's akin to an efficiency rating, which, you know, if you were looking at it from a basketball perspective, would be net rating. It's two steps removed from being able to convert offensive efficiency into, you know, points per possession and points allowed per possession, and then that's how you get to that net. It's adjusted for strength of schedule as well. On top of that, you look at a multi-year sample. There's value in trying to avoid one-year aberrations, particularly with respect to teams that sustain significant losses. You know, when you look at this year's rankings, the the 2018 preseason rankings that diverge most dramatically from the 2017 year-end rankings, there are some kind of notable reasons why. St. Joe's, for example, playing the season without Mike Restivo. High Point playing the season without their faceoff specialist. You know, whether or not these are solutions that were accomplished, there's a reason that their 2017 performance was very aberrant from their 2015 and 16 performance, and it makes more sense to bet on, you know, there's some logic behind betting on 2018 looking more like the composite of the 3 years as opposed to their most recent season. So put together, you know, a ranking put together a document based on last year's year-end rankings, then parse out the players that graduated, the seniors that are going to lead the team, the returning sophomores and juniors that represent the core of the personnel, and then the newcomers that are expected to make contributions. It's actually a thing that's really helpful to look at visually because you can kind of see the volume. It is silly to the degree that you can actually kind of like get duped by teams that have long last names.
A lot of Polish guys.
Exactly. Like, you know, if there's like, you know, Van Raphorst or Giles Harris looks like four guys, you know, you can be artificially influenced to say, oh, wow, Duke's bringing back a lot. But that's something that we work to make sure we don't fall trap to. It's just one of the funny kind of nuances to our approach. When you look at that array, it makes it easier to move teams up and down. You know, one of the things that when we get toward the end of the process and start to really dive into one team versus the other, you know, that you got to decide is what are we trying to accomplish? Are the rankings supposed to forecast how the 2018 season is going to end? Are they supposed to create odds on the likelihood of each team winning the national championship in descending order? Are they supposed to suggest what we think each team's strength is going to be at the beginning of the season? Or how do you account for the rate of improvement, the expected rate of improvement over the course of the year? I think each of those are justifiable efforts. And I don't know that I would necessarily say we have honed in on one choice, meaning that it's an amalgam of all three of those things. But to the point that I made earlier, we can't take pride in ranking the team that wins the national championship number one in the preseason and then turn around and say, well, we're not trying to rank teams based on the likelihood that they win the national championship. You know what I mean? So clearly there's something there. How do you approach what we're trying to accomplish?
Well, to your point about the number one team is not predicting the national championship. They're kind of in tiers. You know what I mean? You gotta kind of think that those top five, six, seven teams are the ones that are in the national championship conversation. Excuse me. You know, you don't want a year like Loyola, where you kind of totally just missed the boat on a team that should have been in that national championship conversation. But, you know, I kind of look at it. It is an amalgam of a bunch of different things. Take Duke and Albany, for instance. We had the opportunity to see these teams in person throughout the fall, you know, when we made these changes. Albany, on paper, probably has a really strong case for number one. That's why when we did this list that you were just speaking of, they were the number one team. They have the most people returning in key positions. They have, you know, really good up the middle with the faceoff guy they have with Connor Fields. They have a solid goalie. They have the most hyped recruit that we've had in a long time, joining that team. But then we got to see them in person against Johns Hopkins at the Headstrong event, and Johns Hopkins really revealed all the questions that there are about this defense. They shined a spotlight on that was not very flattering to Albany. So that's where we were able to change that. So there's kind of there's the first step that's on paper, and then there's a little bit you got to go with the eye test, and you got to go with history to some extent. I know people hate to hear that. We aren't the type that are going to pick the last year's national champion just for the sake of that. But it is a consideration that I'd say even if Maryland had more losses, they'd still probably be in that top five conversation because of the way that John Tillman has just gotten this team to the Final Four pretty much all the time. So there is a little bit of that aspect. And in terms of, are we picking the national championship? The national champion is going to be Duke and they're going to play against Albany? No. We're saying these are the teams that are positioned and have various data sets that would say they're in this conversation.
Yeah, so that's a little bit of a glimpse into the process versus product conversation. I think people are interested, but I don't think we should talk about it for too long, so let's move on. But before we do, Matt, I am horrible at buying gifts for people in my life. I'm horrible in both ways. I can't come up with good ideas, and I always wait to the last minute to buy them. As a result, a disproportionate percentage of the gifts that I buy for the people in my life are tickets to events. It's kind of my default. I'm like, all right, well, I don't really believe this person actually needs anything, or I can't remember what they said they wanted, or I can't remember the moment that they said, oh, it would be nice if I had that, because I am bad as a human being at those things.
That's a pro move.
Right. And
buying an experience seems much more thoughtful than just buying something from Macy's.
And trust me, it is so much easier. And it's even easier now that I've got SeatGeek. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone. A couple weeks ago, I talked about how I use it to go with my dad to the Ohio State-Michigan game in 2016. We went to a little bit more of an obscure game. We went to LSU Chattanooga this year. I got family that lives in Baton Rouge. We had never been to Baton Rouge. And shout out to Tom Arth, coach of the Chattanooga Mox. He's a St. Ignatius alum, and it was cool to see him on the sidelines. We were literally in the first row of Death Valley. It was wild. I got the tickets on SeatGeek. It's the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere with just a few taps, instantly find seats, and that's because it's designed to make your buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make it your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, sports, concerts, comedy, and theater. You're a big concert guy. Is your closest concert in the rear view? Did you just recently attend one, or do you have one coming up?
You know, I have nothing on the schedule right now.
So what was the last concert you went to?
Just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Saw the Descendants.
Ah, that's right. You were talking about that. Yeah. How was it?
It was awesome. Got my tickets on SeatGeek. Used the app. I'm a big, I'll wait till the last minute if I need to. And that's what SeatGeek is great for. You know, check the day before, see if the price has gone down. You know, someone has a last minute
emergency. Someone panicked, yeah.
I take advantage.
So, unfortunately for us, we've already gotten our $20 off our first SeatGeek purchase. But if you haven't used it yet, this is still available to you. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code LACROSSE today. That's promo code LACROSSE for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Promo code LACROSSE. Matt, we're going to end this podcast by talking about last weekend's IMLCA convention. Annually, it's an important weekend for the sport for a variety of reasons. And you summarized 5+ takeaways from the weekend. How would you characterize the conversations that unfolded? Well, first of all, I guess, like, how do you outline the timeline of events and the role that Inside Lacrosse plays?
You know, for us, it's been the past probably 5 years or so, we've invited about the top 25 Division I coaches to come to the office and do a lot of preseason content. And it's really a great source of, not only are you getting great videos that are going to run on InsideLacrosse.com, but you have a lot of just candid conversation with these coaches as we're kind of waiting in our offices. You know, they're not quite in that competition mode yet, where everything is kind of a state secret. So we're having a lot of just good state of the game conversations. And the bigger picture, everyone's kind of in a mindset of improving the game and making the game better and having constructive conversations. So we kind of build on those with those guys. And so it's really revealing stuff that we get from this. In terms of the tone of the conversations, a lot more positive than I'd say past years.
What do you attribute that to?
Organization. The kind of running theme was we came to this meeting with an agenda. They weren't coming to
put together the agenda and then meet.
Right. You don't have a meeting to talk about what you're meeting about, was kind of the general gist of what these coaches were saying. So everyone's in a good mood about that. Shotcock was a topic of heavy discussion in terms of the rules committee, hot topic of the year, which I guess shot clock has been the topic of discussion for a long time, but it shifted this year, the way that they're talking about the shot clock. You know, of the 25 or so guys who came in here, I don't think there was a single one who said that they didn't expect a shot clock. So
were there any that said they didn't want one?
There was various levels of, I'm not excited about it, but really no adamantly against it, if that makes any sense. There's people who would live without it, but kind of see it as like one of those things that I don't think it's going to change too much, so I'm okay with it.
One of the things that I heard that I thought was really smart is there's a way in which you can miscast widespread acceptance for consensus. And one of the things that's happening is because it's not a binary decision, it's a no or yes and. A lot of guys are saying, I'm okay with yes as long as it's my and.
Or but I'll live with yes as long as it's my and.
But if it's not, then I'm a no.
Right.
And I think that that is a interesting dynamic for the leadership to have to navigate.
And this conversation they're having is arguably the more difficult conversation. There's a million different ways the shot clock can be, applied to college lacrosse. It's not just, it's not like everyone got in a room and said, we are looking at this form of a shot clock. The general idea of a shot clock has gotten enough acceptance, or at least enough inevitability, that everyone has accepted that is going to happen. Now it's which of these million different ways, and down to the smallest kind of end of game scenario, are we going to push through to the NCAA Rules Committee? And just so people know, the NCAA Rules Committee meets over the summer, so they'll meet the summer
in
after
early
this
August.
Coming.
Yeah.
August after this college lacrosse season, and implement those rules for the next year, usually. Sometimes, I guess, they have done
starting. Yeah, like the women delayed one year for Division II and Division III for the shot clock, right?
Yeah. So the but the Rules Committee meets on two-year cycles, so they won't be able to make changes until two summers from then. So that's just kind of to lay the groundwork. I'm not sure if people really know how this functionally works.
So you're to say it another way, if they do not make a decision in August 2018 for the 2019 season, then it will be August of 2020 before they can make a decision.
Right.
For the 2021 season.
I think there are
some
rare exceptions for something that is detrimental to the game that they've encountered, but given that we've gone this long without a shot clock, that would not be the case in this scenario.
So on Monday, Tuesday, I think the vibe was no consensus. You would be foolish to try to bet on one specific implementation of the shot clock as being the likeliest outcome.
I texted a coach and he literally laughed at me. His response was, ha ha, consensus.
I had a conversation on Wednesday morning with a guy who I characterize as being one of the most in the know guys that I talk to on a frequent basis. He's a Division I head coach, and he was more confident in a possible outcome than anybody else that I've talked to over the course of this conversation. He thinks that the, quote, shot clock we're going to go with is 90 seconds from the start of possession, 30 seconds to clear, and that the do we or don't we is if the is there a restart, and if there is a restart, what is the duration? I think that there's opposition to it being 90 seconds. I think once people started to float the idea of just not having a restart, that actually kind of some guys perked up at that. They're like, yeah, okay. I mean, I'm fine with just, and in that case, it's not a shot clock because you can't reset the clock with a shot. It's just a possession clock. You get the ball, you have 90 seconds to do something to score. Otherwise, the opposing team gets the ball.
Don't. Yeah, I think the thing that was revealed as, consensus is not the right word, but an idea that people liked was the 30 seconds to clear over midline, or the 90 second clock, midline being kind of the clearing point. I guess there was some talk of the clearing time being a little bit different, but the possession box not being the point at which the shot clock is triggered. I think people saw that in the fall. Patrick's story that he wrote on the website outlined a lot of reasons why he thought that was a bad idea, and I think a lot of the coaches agreed with that in terms of they saw a lot of guys, instead of stepping into the box, would look over to the bench and say, are we going to sub? Am I going to try to kill some time? I got 10 seconds I can kill right here before I get into the possession box. So I think that's the one thing that maybe is off the table in terms of what coaches want to see.
Also off the table, did you hear anybody bring up a two-point line? Because I
did. A few.
Oh, really?
But I'm trying to think who it was, but it was very few. Out of the 25, I would say maybe two or three. And they were more of, do we do a two-point line? Not, I advocate for a two-point line.
And I think that there is a general understanding that these rule changes can or will be incremental.
Right.
And so there's a desire to create a set of rules that makes it easiest to change. The idea being it would be easier to make a clock shorter than it would be to make it longer.
One coach did pose the, I like 75 seconds, but let's do 90. You know, I like 75 seconds and a two-point line, but let's do 90 with no two-point line. Those are steps we can take in 4 years
right.
if we feel like the game is either shifted or just the results that we're getting aren't what we expected. It's easier to go, you know, start conservative and go the other way with it than it is to go opposite.
And let me make one point to address the haters out there that talk about tweaking rules and how, why can't we just have the same set of rules for an extended period of time? No sport has the same set of rules for the extended period of time. If that's the standard that you think that we're aspiring to, like, you're just not paying attention to the sports landscape. Every sport changes their rules like every year or two. Now, are the rules as dramatic always as implementing a fixed shot clock? No, but kind of yes. You're trying to tell me that replay in Major League Baseball wasn't as significant as implementing a shot clock in lacrosse? That removing all of the headshots from football wasn't as significant as implementing a shot clock in lacrosse?
Changing the kickoff line?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, these are really significant changes that are happening on an annual basis. The targeting rule in college football is more significant than a shot clock in college lacrosse. I won't hear otherwise. So the idea that, like, we're exhibiting our novelty as a sport by virtue of how easily malleable the rules are, I do not accept that. And so the goal is to create the best game possible. The definition of best is very subjective. And so that's why the conversations occur so frequently, because they're building on the momentum of the increased willingness to change.
And we talk the incremental changes that we're doing. This is exactly what we've been doing for the last few cycles, is there have been half measures that are leading up to this shot clock. We're just getting to the point where the Band-Aid is already three quarters pulled off, and we're just getting the last little bit off of it right now.
No question. So let's move on from the conversation about the rules, although I will say that compared to IMLCA conventions past, and by the way, I think it's worth saying, the IMLCA is the Men's Coaches Association.
Yes.
They meet the second weekend in December in Baltimore annually, and their meeting place is about a five-minute walk from inside the lacrosse offices. So a very convenient event for us to be a part of. And I think that beyond conversation about the rules, they hosted the annual awards luncheon that honored the coaches of the year, had an assistant, as well as a variety of other recipients for other contributions to the sport of lacrosse. They hosted their, I believe, third Hall of Fame induction, third class Hall of Fame induction. And then there were a lot of business meetings about the nature of the sport. You know, anything that you feel strongly about having taken away from any of the other kind of things that unfolded over the course of the weekend?
You know, a few weeks ago, we did a podcast where we talked about scheduling. Excuse me, guys. I'm fading here with my cough here. But we talked about scheduling and how vastly things can change pretty quickly when it comes to, you know, we were talking about this in the lens of the Navy Hopkins game. That all changed with ACC tournament and Patriot League tournament having drastic changes. The ACC tournament stuff has actually been, you know, I've seen people who have kind of aggregated our report have said that it was ruled on at the convention. It wasn't. It was done before that. Patriot League tournament decision was made at the convention. The coaches voted to shift their tournament back into May. Patriot League has typically been earlier, where their conference tournament has been held in April. ACC tournament, though, is a wild change in terms of over 2 weeks.
Well, hold on. Time out. So let's just quickly set the table. Up to 2013, the ACC tournament took place the second last weekend of the regular season. It was a four-team tournament, very clean. Carolina, Duke, Virginia, Maryland. Conference realignment meant that there was a six-team tournament for... Well, I actually can't remember now, because how did it play with Maryland? And then, so was there a 16 tournament for just 1 year, just the 2014 season?
Yes.
And then there's been a 5-team tournament for the three
seasons. But one of the 5-team years, they still had an AQ.
Right. So two of the 5 years. It was only this past year. Only in 2017 did they lose their AQ. So for the last 3 years, the ACC tournament has hosted essentially like a exhibition for the fifth place team, and stuck to its traditional semifinal final format. That opponent had been Brown. Most recently, it was Penn. And correct if I'm wrong, but Virginia has played in that game each of the last 3 years.
Yes.
That is going away. Basically, they added a quarterfinal round in which the fourth and fifth place team play into a traditional four-team bracket. The difference is now that the fourth and fifth place game and then the two semifinals take place the second last weekend of the season, and then the championship takes place the last weekend of the season.
A few things here about the, you know, I think the initial reaction was, why the heck are they doing this? It's really tough to schedule that, you know. The other option is there's four teams, the fifth place team, you're out of luck. You know, that's kind of the, if we want to be frank, that's the simple solution to all of this. If the fifth place team wants to be involved, which, considering the
implications to strength of schedule, yeah.
Is that's a reason why they want all five teams to be involved. But that fifth place team would typically play an Ivy League team because the Ivy League has an odd number of teams in the conference. So there's going to be a team that has, that doesn't have a conference game that weekend. So that's kind of why it's been an Ivy League team. From what I understand, the ACC didn't really like another conference being involved in their tournament. Plus just the difficulty of scheduling that one team that has, you know, that week open. It's tough to do. You know, there's a lot of considerations that go into making these schedules. So that's kind of the how of why we got here. Stuff to consider with this, though, is what about the travel? What if Notre Dame is the number one team? Then you have all of these teams that are flying for the semifinal weekend to South Bend. Then a week later, flying back to South Bend.
Presuming
that Notre Dame wins, flying back to South Bend for the championship game. That's a lot of money that's going to be spent in a very short window on travel. So that's just one thing to consider. And also, I'm curious about TV. This is just my kind of thinking about the situation is, what incentive does ESPNU have to air the ACC championship if it's not an AQ? Obviously, they're two high-profile teams that are going to be in the event.
So but on that weekend, they're already airing five games, six games.
And that presumably, have stakes for an NCAA tournament.
Presumably birth. One that has a conflict time-wise because they're airing so many games, it's likely going to fall in the same window.
So,
and particularly given that they're not going to know where that game's being played until the week prior, which is a problem as it relates to their program scheduling. I'm sure that they will. ESPN's right. Relationship with the ACC is very deep, and as a result, the question is it the best possible solution? And I don't think we have an answer.
And coaches are split on this in the ACC. You know, there was definitely some coaches who were adamantly against this. I will put it at that. Very adamantly against this.
And then others who were heavily in favor of it.
Yeah. And there was confusion over the voting. You know, there was kind of a weird situation where some coaches didn't want to, you know, be the only person not to vote for it. And then when they started talking to their fellow coaches after the vote, they were like, hey, I wasn't going to vote for it either. So it kind of turned in from a unanimous thing to like a pretty much even split. And by that point, it's already kind of been ushered through. So a weird situation.
And so for the Patriot League, the challenge in the Patriot League is it's huge. There's nine teams in the league, so you have to play eight league games. You start really early in the season in order to play eight consecutive weekends or eight out of nine consecutive weekends and be done by the second weekend in April in order to play, or the second to last weekend in April in order to play your conference tournament on the last weekend in April and then have an open date the following week. You know, that. A lot of the reasons that these decisions were made initially had to do with finals, and so as that was related, you know, it's a function of if we don't have to play a game that week, we'd prefer not to, but if we do have to, we'll figure out a way to make it work.
We'll play our conference tournament game, but we're not going to play a random out-of-conference game if it's going to conflict with our finals.
So for a couple of those squads, the opponent, being an ACC opponent, was a really valuable proposition for the program. Over the last several years, Army has played Notre Dame, Boston University has played Duke, and Colgate has played Syracuse. That is a really nice boost to the RPI for the Patriot League as a conference and for those individual teams, almost to the degree that Army got in on the strength of their win over Notre Dame after losing in the Patriot League tournament the week prior. Those coaches and the other coaches for whom RPI and strength schedule as a conference is really important, didn't want to lose those games and as a result opposed moving the tournament back. But now that the ACC has already done that and they lost those games, they're not opposed to it. So now it's like, all right, well, let's pick up that additional week earlier in the season, and maybe we can find ways to keep these series alive earlier in the year. And it sounds like in some instances that's going to happen. And it feels like the most direct effect is the return of the Hopkins Navy game.
Yeah, from what I understand, for a lot of the Patriot League opponents, they're going to be able to schedule a big non-conference game somewhere in that late February window, which is where I believe that the Hopkins Navy game is going to fall now. You know, I think that last weekend in February, starting 2019, is going to be the return of that rivalry.
And so beyond that, scheduling was obviously a very significant move. The business of the IMLCA I mentioned earlier was something that was discussed, and I think that there's still a lot that's going to unfold there. Matt, any other takeaways from the IMLCA convention?
Not the IMLCA convention, but we had the pleasure to attend the Jack Sandler leadership dinner a few days prior, and just a great event. You know, I don't think either of us kind of have the right to speak about Jack too much because we didn't really know him that well. But just being in a room with a bunch of people who were affected by him, Ryan Mulner put together a great event there. I know you emceed it. It was just moving to kind of hear those stories. And it's, you know, the thing that I said in my story was it's just what coaching is all about, what this coaching community is all about. There were guys there who had other stuff. There's other stuff they could have been doing. There's a lot of business going on down here. But they were there to celebrate Jack's life and raise a lot of money in the meantime. So it was just a great event.
Yeah, so the Jack Sandler Leadership Foundation, or Fund, essentially scholarships lacrosse players to be able to go to different types of events, whether they be recruiting or camps and clinics, et cetera. And the thing about that I love is the core identity is so in line with the way that he lived his life. It's about giving young athletes access to coaches. And to your point about the character in the room and the characters in the room, providing that access is a noble goal. And I think that being able to see it happen in person in that room was an extremely exciting proposition and a reflection of the legacy that he leaves behind. So a great note to end on as we discuss.
One more note. John Tillman now has a tattoo.
A great note to end on as we talk about the IMLCA convention. Matt, it was a pleasure watching you power through this one. We appreciate all the work to keep those pipes clean. Thank you to our sponsors, RX Bar and SeatGeek. Make sure to check out both of them, SeatGeek.com, promo code lacrosse, or download the app and enter promo code lacrosse today, rxbar.com/lacrosse. And we will get back to you tomorrow with the IL Preps podcast.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.